This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of Segregated Space, On Progress, a presentation by art historian Murtaza Vali as part of Arte East's Across Histories lecture series. It took place on November 18th, 2009.
Thank you very much for coming, everybody. I'd like to start off by thanking Lauren and the rest of the people at Arte East for inviting me to present part of my research for this talk series. And I'd like to thank Cabinet Space for hosting. I do want to start off with a caveat of sorts, and that is that...
Would you prefer the lights off or
off? I'd...
This is off.
Yeah, this is fine, actually.
This is good?
Yeah. As long as people can see the images. Oh.
Thanks.
So like I said, I'm going to be presenting, but I have a bit of a caveat, and that is that I'm presenting the project, and then I'll be presenting sort of two interrelated streams of analysis that I'm adopting towards understanding how the project might work. As an art project and as a political intervention, specifically in the space in which it's cited, which is Sharjah. So I'm going to present the project to you, and because I tend to get a little nervous, I have written out a lot of it, but feel free to interrupt me in the middle, and I'll be more than happy to...
Can I do that right away, actually?
Yeah, sure.
I forgot to ask you to clip on the mic.
Oh.
So if you can clip that on, that'd be great. Like around, like here is good.
Okay. Okay, so, wow, I've never been mic'd before. But like I said, so feel free to interrupt me at any point if you guys need more information, more background. I've tried to include a little bit of background, but, you know, there might be things that other people don't know that would be helpful for their understanding. So I'm going to begin. I'm going to begin with a slide that actually shows absolutely nothing whatsoever. But I did put it in here just in case people have no sense of what we're talking about. And so the project that I'm talking about sort of spans the Indian Ocean. And the city that where it was sited is in the United Arab Emirates on this side of the Persian Gulf. And I realized that I should have gotten a map that actually had Sharjah on there. But I kind of wanted to show the region more than the site of the project, because the region is sort of the idea that I'm pushing with the analysis. Presented at the 9th Sharjah Biennial, the Camps Wharfage Project examined a minor maritime trade route between the city's old port and the various semi-state entities that comprise contemporary Somalia. Sharjah is the third largest emirate in the UAE, more conservative and modest than neighboring Dubai and oil-rich capital Abu Dhabi. Sharjah has long been a champion of art and culture in the region. The biennial, originally regional in stature, expanded its scope in 2003 once it was taken over by the Sheikh's daughter, who had just returned home after completing an arts degree in London. I guess nepotism is not always all bad. Since its 2005 edition, Jack Persekian, a Jerusalem-based curator, has been associated with the event in various capacities and has transformed it into an important laboratory for critical art practice in the Middle East. Free from the commercial taint of Dubai and the overblown institutional ambitions of Abu Dhabi. Since 2003, the biennial has shifted from being merely a temporary exhibitionary platform, albeit with an increasingly global reach, to being intricately involved in the processes of art production through its expanding commissions program and artists' residencies. On preliminary research trips, members of CAMP, and CAMP is a group based in Mumbai that resists the term artists' collective. They basically consider themselves a platform for research, and a lot of their research and interventions involve a lot of media and technology, because those are their sorts of preferred forms of making interventions And they've, I'll leave it at that. So on preliminary research trips, members of camp were drawn to the Old Port, which lies adjacent to the city's so-called Heritage and Arts District. So this is a view down the road running alongside the Charter Creek, and it shows the Dow Wharfage, which is along the side there. Again, I apologize for these maps, but which lies adjacent to the city's so-called Heritage and Art Districts, which house a variety of cultural institutions, including the Sharjah Art Museum, which is the hub of the biennial. So the road we were looking down is the Corniche Road that runs along the north of the, at the top of the image. And of the two darkly shaded areas to the right, of the two darkly shaded areas in the top left, the one on the right is what I'm going to show a close-up of in the next image. So this is basically what's called the Heritage and Arts Districts. I call them the so-called Heritage and Arts Districts for a reason. This area was the old heart of the city, its commercial hub. An old Irani market ran parallel to the creek in between it and the museum's present location. So just to the, where it says Old Souk is basically where there was an old market. Though these buildings now have a suitably antique-looking patina, the original structures were raised and rebuilt using savage building materials within the last decade or so. So although they kind of look weathered now, they're only about a decade and a half old. And in a lot of cases, I think the original architecture was rebuilt, but the fact that it was rebuilt is kind of significance, I think. I remember when I first walked through the rebuilt area, everything was gleaming white to the point where it was almost blinding in the summer sun. So the project emerged out of weeks of open-ended research conducted in and around the port. Simply by talking and listening to the people who live and work there. Chance conversations revealed the origins of the boats and crews and their destinations. They discovered that this trade was exclusively conducted by dhows, the traditional wooden boats indigenous to the Arabian Gulf, South Asia, and East Africa, made in and operated out of Salaya, Gujarat, a region of West India famous for building exactly such boats. The crews were largely Gujarati Muslims from Salaya. And the dhows would carry cargo between Sharjah and various ports in contemporary Somalia. So this research revealed a complex triangular network of commercial and cultural exchange that crisscrossed the Indian Ocean and that itself had a deep history. Wharfage, the project, was a diptych of sorts, consisting of a book and a performance. So to start off with, I'll discuss the book. The book was distributed freely and you can download it as a PDF at this link. A version in other languages was planned, but was apparently not published in time. The book is very simple. It consists of an essay outlining the theoretical triggers for the project, some photographs documenting the various sites encountered during the research phase. These are the shipbuilding yards in Salaya, and I'm sorry they're oriented sideways, but that's the way the book's, I was trying to stay true to the book. And the wharfage in Sharjah. And these are just photographs of the sorts of activities that happen on that little stretch of the dock that I showed in the first photograph. But its bulk is just lists, shipping manifests, inventories of the cargo that the ships leaving and arriving Sharjah were carrying. It presented 2 years' worth of such data in a straightforward, easy-to-read and understand format. It treated this information as a found object, extracting it from its inaccessible location buried deep in the port's... buried deep in the port's customs office files, rescuing it from the bureaucratic archive and recontextualizing it. Black type was used to designate a trip from Sharjah. Blue type was for one to Sharjah. I hope everybody can read this. All the different products carried were compiled into a litany of goods presented as an alphabetical appendix at the back of the book. So this is that litany of goods. The list revealed the material particularities and distinct dynamics of this particular trade route, highlighting both links and disparities, cultural, political, and economic, between the various nodes in this network. All kinds of consumer goods, used and new, went to Somalia, indicating a hyperactive import market. So the work, the column on the left is the sorts of things that go. And like I said, if you guys download the book, you'll notice that this is just one of 120 pages of similar things. And the discrepancy is pretty consistent. The work going, the stuff going to Somalia, the lists are long. And the lists of stuff coming from Somalia are fairly abbreviated. I also have a copy of the book here, which I can pass around if people are curious. So all kinds of consumer goods, used and new, went to Somalia, indicating a hyperactive import market. Most of the boats returned with charcoal or stone, or often empty, indicating the scarcity of exportable product and highlighting the economic imbalance that decades of lawlessness and violence have precipitated. This Somalia-bound trade was conducted out of this port rather than the more modern Port Khalid close by because of its particularly low wharfage fee, which is the fee for docking your boat there. The first 6 days are free, after which it is merely 20 dirhams per day. 20 dirhams is about $7. Hence the project's title, which points both to the site at which these transactions are enacted and the specific local economics that facilitate this site as the location of these transactions. So wharfage was a diptych, as I mentioned. The other aspect of it was a performance. The performance consisted of four nightly pirate radio broadcasts, dubbed Radio Mina 100.3 FM was its address on the dial, and it was called Mina after the port. The old port is called Mina, which I think actually is, I should look this up, is the Arabic term for port. So the performance consisted of four nightly pirate radio broadcasts during the biennial's opening week, conducted at a dhow moored in the port, the MSV Nazre Karam. The nightly activity attracted dozens of people from the port's immediate vicinity, many who became regular attendees over the four nights. It brought together the different ethnic groups involved in the functioning of this minor trade economy. The Gujarati crews, the Somali traders, these photographs are largely of Somali traders, the Pakistani loaders, the Iranian shopkeepers from the adjacent Irani bazaar, and the occasional inquisitive Emirati official. Despite the cultural differences, trade had necessitated the emergence of a common language, Urdu, which was surprisingly spoken and understood to varying degrees by many of the different parties involved. The programming was open and improvised, shaped largely by the desires of the various protagonists linked to and by this trade network. The members of camp served as facilitators, largely managing the technical side of the broadcasts, establishing formats that would encourage participation and dialogue, conducting interviews, drawing out characters and stories, both expected and unexpected. People talked about their own work, day-to-day life on the sea and at the port. Communication was established by crews at sea, as close by as Oman and as far away as Bosaso on Somalia's northern coast. There was plenty of singing and dancing, both surprisingly good and gut-wrenchingly bad. Music, favorite songs were exchanged, downloaded off of cell phones, and broadcast. But it was not all smooth sailing. There was friction, as one might expect, as conversations across ethnic divisions, language barriers, and class differences ensued. All the while, camp maintained a conscious antagonism to the biennial and its audiences, who were kept peripheral to the activities at the port. Overt presence in the biennial spaces, the museum, and its immediate environs was strategically avoided. A listening station was set up outside, but adjacent to the museum, on a roof accessed by a barely marked wooden ladder, where one found a hodgepodge of modern-looking furniture, copies of the book, and radios tuned in to the broadcast. Just so you guys have a sense. That roof is, in this photograph, this little building that juts out there, it's that roof right there. And the museum, the actual museum is right here. And so while a lot of this area is used for biennial activities, it was kind of nondescript. And a lot of the people that I ran into over the course of the opening week were constantly wondering where the hell everything was going on. And when I talked to the group, they said that that was definitely very conscious on their part. Other similarly outfitted listening stations on either side of the Creek Road were not distinct enough to attract the attention of a biennial visitor unfamiliar with the area. So they're very nondescript. It's just a few chairs and a lamp and a bunch of donated radios that apparently in the first day or two got flicked by a lot of people. But they managed to tie some down to the furniture. And, those sufficed for the rest of the days. These stations served to expand the broadcast's audience, to draw in more participants. They served as spaces for people who participated in a previous broadcast to merely listen in on the proceedings. In recent years, Dubai has emerged as the epitome of neoliberal multiculturalism, where a consumer-driven cosmopolitan lifestyle throws people from disparate nations and cultures together. Young professionals with significant disposable incomes. I'm sorry, I don't have a photo of people dancing in a club, but I probably should have. Disposable incomes party in the city's many trendy clubs every Thursday night and try to drink through the pain of their hangovers at boozy Friday brunches. Wharfage was a parody of such exclusive cosmopolitan spaces of consumption and leisure to which most of its participants would most certainly be denied access. It celebrated a parallel subaltern cosmopolitanism based not on the wants afforded by privilege, but the needs of labor. The party was held in plain public view, open to any and everyone. It also tapped into the romance of the radio, of sound or voice carrying across space, distance, its waves hovering over the ocean's waves below, simultaneously suggesting both distance and connection. The broadcasts provided its participants with a voice and an opportunity and a space in which to exercise its potential. An opportunity to create their own enjoyment and to control their own leisure time, to be heard and to be taken seriously, to tell their stories. What emerged was a portrait of the port as a nexus for the exchange of peoples, goods, and ideas between the Emirates, Iran, India, Somalia, and beyond. For a few hours, these broadcasts became a hub for cross-cultural interaction and exchange and temporarily brought into view the hidden textures of maritime trade, giving voice and agency to people, cultures, and languages normally marginalized in this society. In his book, Conversation Pieces, Grant Kester outlines the conditions of what he calls dialogical aesthetics. Aesthetics understood not as bound to an autonomous object, but discursive, emerging through and as dialogic encounters. Repeated over four evenings, Wharfage created exactly such a ritualistic space for intercultural conversation, carved out a forum for dialogue, exchange, and intersubjective encounters. It created, if only fleetingly and symbolically, the possibility of a democratic public sphere in a monarchy whose society is strongly segregated along class, race, ethnicity, language, and gender lines. So now this part's a little more in the works, and so what I was thinking about doing was outlining the two sorts of I guess you could call them methodological approaches I am taking to analyzing this particular work. And so the first one of those two is to examine it in relation to its site, and specifically to the particular labor ecology of the United Arab Emirates, which, for people who may not know, is largely immigrant. 70 to 80% of the population is from the outside. And a significant number of that immigrant population is from South Asia, and a lot of them are basically serve in indentured servitude of sorts. They have no political voice, no political agency. They're not allowed any sort of political organizing or protest. Any sorts of protests are stymied by the government, and it extends to the degree where the media is actually not allowed to cover anything related to such issues because it's under a censorship law that the media is not allowed to say or do anything that adversely affects the economy of the country. So that's kind of the background. And I'm just going to go through a bunch of other attempts that to address kind of this particular political conundrum through art projects. A lot of them are commissioned through the biennial, and which is why I see the biennial as being a particularly important and critical space for such discourses in the region. But a couple are just sort of random other projects that I thought were interesting. So this is the first project from 2005, and it's by the Swiss photographer Beats Truly, and this is showing three frames from what was a double channel slide projection, which basically sort of recreated his sort of landmark style in Sharjah. And Al-Aruba Street is a commercial road that runs parallel to the Creek Road that has long been like the hub of commercial activity in the city. And although you can't tell from this particular set of images, what emerged over watching the piece for a while was you got some sense of the diversity of the community that sort of wanders through these areas, but you only got it sort of subtly. It wasn't, you know, smacked over your head. So it was only over time that you realized that there weren't that many women walking in and around, and that people who were immediately recognizable as local Arabs were infrequent. And that, you know, a lot of the people who did show up in his photographs were, you know, young South Asian men. So this was in the 2005 biennial, three editions ago. This is from the 2007 biennial, and it's by a guy named Vladimir Arkhipov, and it's called Naming Forms. And he's an artist who has done a similar project in many different sites around the world, and he, again, like Struli, adapted it for this particular setting. These were all commissions done through the biennial's sort of ever-expanding commissions program. And basically what he does is he kind of creates a folk archive that's usually cited or that emerges in and around a site. And so his site this time around was the environs around the museum and reflecting it. What he picks are objects that are constructed by others that he finds sort of interesting or compelling, that kind of evoke like an ad hoc aesthetic sensibility. They're kind of like assisted ready-mades or ready-mades almost. And so for this particular installation, the shot on the right, which is a display of the gallery, as it was shown in the biennial, and the two images on the left are, I guess, research shots. And so the image on the top left is a set of thread spools that he saw at a nearby tailor store. The image on the bottom is a sort of a reconstituted fan where the broken base has been replaced with this kind of cement pedestal and two wooden stakes. And you can see the set of thread spools on the in the gallery space on the right. The other important thing about this installation that the installation shot doesn't convey is that every piece was accompanied with a wall text that actually had a little bit of a dialogue between the artist and the person whose object it was. But it was very sort of minor to the actual installation. What I thought was much more interesting and was significantly larger visually was he presented the person's name and their contact number, so just a telephone number in case you wanted to actually engage in a conversation. And what was interesting about this piece was that it was very, I found it to be incredibly sort of very modest in its approach to some degree. It didn't kind of fixate on an image of, you know, a community that's sort of dispossessed and disenfranchised. It actually instead celebrated sort of elements of creativity within that community. Okay, so the next project is this, which was shown at an art fair in Dubai in 2008 as part of an exhibition that was called Desperately Seeking Paradise. It was an exhibition of work by contemporary artists from Pakistan that was commissioned by the fair as an sort of alternative space within the fair itself. And this particular work by the Pakistani artist Huma Mulji actually seems to have attracted a lot of negative attention, and this work and a couple of other works that she showed in proximity were vandalized and removed, and had to be removed a day into the the shows run. But basically what it does is, it's basically a taxidermy camel stuffed into a suitcase, and it's part of a series of works that she produced that are about, that use suitcases to kind of interrogate the sorts of ideas and sorts of concepts and sorts of things people travel with when they go back and forth. And so with this, she was talking not only about the fact that the camel itself is a symbol that belongs both to South Asia, to the parts of South Asia that she belongs to, which is Karachi, and the Middle East, but also to the fact that there are large numbers of young boys from Pakistan who are smuggled into the UAE to serve as jockeys for camel racing. But you know, on top of that, also the fact that the camel itself has been sort of highly commodified and instrumentalized as a symbol for the Gulf. And I read this particular project as a way of kind of reappropriating that symbol as something that applies to all of the areas around the Indian Ocean, all areas to which this animal might be indigenous. And then this is another, this is a piece from the most recent biennial that was by a Danish artist. And what it consisted of was a series of video portraits of migrant workers on the left and their families in Kerala on the right. So the artist basically did some research, found a bunch of migrant workers who were working in different spaces in Sharjah, and then basically traveled with a crew to Kerala. And he shot these fairly straightforward shots of the worker and his family. And the two shots were situated on the two sides of a very dark room, and they were very crisp and clean. And the piece is called Rendezvous. And so the viewer is situated within the two, within the space of kind of like nostalgia and homesickness and yearning for connection. But what's interesting in comparison to this, in comparison to Camp's work, is that this still is very much fixated on kind of a humanistic portrayal of the workers, showing their sort of dire circumstances and conditions. And this is the final project that I want to talk about, that is from not the most recent biennial, but from the 2007 biennial, by a group called Explo and Irene Anastas, called I Love to You, Workers' Voices from the UAE. And this basically consisted of a CD, and I'm showing the front and the back of the CD, of worker songs in their own languages that were collected over the research period by the group and then recorded onto this CD. And the CD itself was then provided to the biennial audience alongside a book that had a bunch of theoretical sort of reflections on voice and issue and on voice and song and protest, and also had a map of a itinerary that the group had worked out that took you from the three different sites where the songs on the CD were supposed to be playing in public space, through a lot of the sort of unseen parts of the city. And so the red basically traces the route across the city, and these little speaker signs were show where the CDs were supposed to be played during the course of the biennial. I actually visited this site down here repeatedly, primarily because I live right down here. And it was interesting to note that actually the CD was never played. And I had a conversation with the guy who was taking care of the park, and he said that it actually upset a lot of the people there. So although the sort of the ideas behind the project and the impetus was very noble, it's the way it actually played out, it didn't seem to work. I will admit that I didn't go to either of the other two locations, so I don't know if the project was more successful there. I also have other reservations about this project in relation to camp, and part of that, in relation to the camp project, and part of that has to do with the fact that any sort of discursivity or dialogic interaction that emerged in this project happened before the fact, happened during the artist's research phase and not during the audience's experience of the work. And so what you end up with to some degree is an object. The audience consumes an object, and it to some degree reinforces a lot of sort of politically problematic notions of how we interact with representations of disenfranchised others. If you listen to the songs are, a lot of them are protest songs. A lot of them are just songs of home and nostalgia and homesickness and yearning. And it's very palpable in the singing. And that's another problem that I have with it. It kind of fetishizes this othered voice rather than in creating a space for dialogue. It actually fetishizes what makes people different. And so these are sort of a few of the projects against which I've been thinking about the camp project. And the other sort of mode of inquiry that I've been exploring is to look at the Indian Ocean and how the project by camp actually activates this idea of the Indian Ocean as a space of connection, not as a space of separation. So the project put into play ideas that I had been mulling over myself of late. What would it mean to reimagine the Indian Ocean as a space of connection, communication, and exchange, rather than as an insurmountable divide, a gulf, if you will? In his introduction to 100 Horizons, the Indian Ocean and the Age of Global Empire, historian Sugata Bose suggests that the widespread devastation caused by the 2004 tsunami underlined, albeit tragically, the idea that the Indian Ocean might be better understood not as a space of separation, but one of contact and exchange, a traversable space that through history has linked the distinct cultures and lands that surround it. My mode of thinking is not entirely novel. The Milan-based group Multiplicity have deployed a similar approach to the Mediterranean Sea in their ongoing Solid Sea project, which thinks of the sea itself as a continent and hence entirely traversable, and paths and trajectories across it traceable. So nautical links between the Gulf, South Asia, and East Africa are millennia old, and there are various itineraries that crisscross the Arabian Sea. There's textual evidence from the Akkadian time period documenting the presence in the harbor of trading vessels from Dilmun, Magan, and Miluha. And this is an archaeological map, a map showing archaeological... It's basically a map showing an earlier time period with both modern and ancient cities. And marked on it are, so Mesopotamia is basically Akkadia. Dilmun is this area that now corresponds to contemporary Bahrain. Magan corresponds to parts of southern Iran, the UAE and Oman. And Miluha is thought to be the Indus, which is contemporary South Asia. Evidence of exchange of material culture and decorative motifs between these areas has also been found. Evidence of millet from East Africa has been discovered in the Indus Valley. Jumping a few millennia ahead, the cities of Mansoura and Multan in the Sindh region of contemporary Pakistan were ruled by Arabs in the 9th and 10th century, rulers who had tenuous relationships to the Abbasid Caliphate in what is now Iraq. Indians from Gujarati merchant communities spread westward, settling in East and South Africa. Others followed as indentured laborers. Gandhi developed many of his strategies for nonviolent political resistance, fighting for their rights in South Africa in the late 19th century, techniques that then traveled back with him across the Indian Ocean to India and were deployed to achieve Indian independence. Jews from Baghdad, expelled in 1948, fled east, resettling in Bombay and Calcutta, some briefly and others more permanently. And since oil was discovered in the Gulf, South Asian and other migrant labor, both professional and menial, has been imported to implement the ambitious and accelerated program of infrastructural development. In the 1980s, under General Zia-ul-Haq, fundamentalist Wahhabi Islam was imported along with Saudi financial aid into Pakistan, leading to the establishment of the Taliban and resulting in the current crisis with radical Islam in that country. Paul Gilroy identifies the sailing ship as the key chronotope or organizing symbol for this theory of the Black Atlantic, for his theory of the Black Atlantic. As a, quote, living microcultural, micropolitical system in motion, the ship is the exemplar of maritime culture, travel and trade, a syncretic heterotopia linking lands separated by bodies of water. For Gilroy, the focus on travel and mobility, the deterritorialized space of the Middle Passage across the Atlantic, and the metaphors it carries with it serves to challenge traditional notions of identity, cultural, ethnic, or national, tied to territorial entities and their carefully policed borders. By visualizing contemporary maritime trade across the Indian Ocean, Wharfage claimed the dhow, which is, of course, a ship, as such a symbol of a broader network of commerce and exchange. This challenged its appropriation as a specifically Emirati symbol. And in this, I'm sort of drawing an analogy to what I was talking about with the camel and the Humamulji project. As a specifically Emirati symbol, one of a handful, others include the camel, a curved dagger, the traditional coffee pot, the date palm, the wind tower, the falcon, the Arab oryx, and more recently, the omnipresent self-proclaimed seven-star Burj Al Arab, and I'm sure in the near future, the world's tallest building, the Burj Dubai. All of these symbols appear on its currency and are repeated in various media, from kitsch tourist souvenirs to equally kitsch contemporary architecture. And so this is a Dao-inspired golf club, and the sort of the simulacral version of the Dao then reappears on the currency itself. And so that's sort of where I'm thinking about some of these ideas, about how this sort of interest or a focus on this middle passage might unsettle Emirati notions or notions of what it might mean to be Emirati, which is often sort of a pure Emirati identity, which tries to remove any traces of others from their culture, when actually the history of this trade shows that people from all over have been traveling in and out of this region for millennia. And while I was sort of researching this project, I came across this, which is sort of underlines the point that the Dao is not a specifically Arab form of transport. It belongs more to the Indian Ocean. And this is a project by the Italian artist Paolo Tamburella, which was presented as the first official participation by the Union of Comoros Islands at this year's Venice Biennale. And it's called the Jahazi, which is the Arabic or Urdu version for ship or vehicle. But I guess it also specifically refers to these type of Dao-type boats. For centuries, these boats have been the only means of transport for the people of Comoros for trade and contact with nearby Tanzania, Madagascar, and Mozambique. In recent times, these traditional vessels have been used to transport shipping containers from cargo boats to land in the port of the capital of Moroni, creating this weird hybrid of age-old and contemporary industrial modes of maritime transport. I find this incredibly fascinating, how the sort of modular form of global shipping is kind of juxtaposed with this tiny little wooden boat. This practice was prohibited following the modernization of the port of Moroni in 2006, and the boats were abandoned in the port and were sinking into the water. For the Biennale, a disused Jahazi was salvaged by the artist, restored, disassembled, shipped to Venice, and then reassembled and loaded with an impossibly immense shipping container, and was moored near the Giardini. So the Giardini is this side of us. During the biennial's opening days, dockers from Moroni used the container as a floating stage to perform traditional Comorian songs and greet the public. And I just like the juxtaposition of the tiny little boat and the really big yacht. So I just want to kind of end there. And like I said, this is kind of a work in progress. So you've kind of gotten fragments of my thinking. And I spent a lot of time over the last couple of weeks trying to come up with a more coherent narrative to present to you guys. Didn't manage it, but I'm getting there. So I'd like to end there. I'd like to thank, of course, the members of CAMP and Bidoon Magazine for commissioning and publishing an interview with CAMP about the Wharfage project which was the original sort of seed for some of these ideas. And now I'd like to open it up to you guys. Oh, I was supposed to end here. And the reason why I put this up there is because what I'm particularly drawn to is the idea of appropriating and disciplining, which is, I think, what I'm trying to get at with the way the projects of the Indian Ocean sort of challenge ideas in this region of ethnic absolutism or national purity. Because to actually create those national identities, you kind of have to keep the flux that these sorts of trade networks bring with them under check. Yeah.
I may have missed this because I came in a little late, but there's a very specific link there to the national, right? The national identity, because of passports. They think about the movement of people, not so much just across the water, but in terms of establishing identity within the UAE. Only people who have parents who are Arab or from that area can gain that passport, right? So how does that link into the formation of identity? Because in that way, it is in fact controlled, right? It is disciplined. The movement of people is precisely disciplined by the state. And so how would that relate to then the practices and the material that you've demonstrated in other art projects as well as camps, that clearly people have been moving around for millennia, things have been coming in and out, but it doesn't actually translate to a state-accepted shift in identity. So essentially what I'm asking is the distinction between cultural identity, right, and the kind of flux that allows, as opposed to national identity. Is there something?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a tough can of worms, but it is one of the things I've been thinking. I mean, how exactly one thinks about public space in a space that's not a democracy is one thing, or public sphere in a space that's not a democracy is one thing, which is kind of why I like the camp project, because it kind of recreated a mini public sphere that was kind of temporary and symbolic, but still was what arguably is missing otherwise. But this issue of nationality is of course key, and I think what's happening is that there are certain tensions arising in the Gulf countries about going from identities or kinship structures or loyalty structures that are tribal, and then somehow adapting those to national, or where how do you extend an allegiance that was based on blood and fairly spatially or proximal, how do you extend it then to the level of nationality? And so one way is by sort of controlling who you give citizenship to and who you don't. And part of the tension of a lot of these projects comes from the fact that none of these people who are being represented, who are the majority of the people who live in these countries, will ever have the possibility of citizenship, or at least not according to the way the laws are structured right now. So I don't know, that's something I'm still trying to work out. There any other questions?
In the one of the earlier pictures you showed of the actual boats actually being nailed together, like were there in the camps project, did they actually build boats too to work with it? Maybe I didn't know.
No. Sorry. That was those were images from the shipyards in Gujarat, which is where the boats are built. So those were all extracted out of the book. So that's another question that emerges a lot in relation to that biennial especially. And I'm not sure. They do a lot of educational outreach, so you definitely have a lot of local students who are passing through the space. Otherwise, you get an international crowd of artists and gallerists and curators who come kind of descend for the opening. But increasingly, I also do feel like you get a broader community of sort of a cultural audience from across the Middle East and arguably even South Asia, who aren't from the West, but who do come to Sharjah to see the biennial and to see what sort of work is in it and what sorts of questions it's asking and things like that. So I do think that Sharjah serves as an interesting laboratory for artists who are based in, say, Tehran or Beirut or Cairo, which are all, you know, cities with longer histories of art scenes and cultural scenes and intellectual scenes too. I actually do not. That's one of the sort of things I need to do a little more research on.
Are they all based around blood and family?
That's what I think, but then there are loopholes that serve the region or the country. So the people who are on the UAE cricket team were all given UAE citizenship so that they were national. And then there's an Indian guy who's been in the country for a very long time, 200 years or so, and he was awarded.
Yes.
Yeah, well, it's a long time for countries that are like 25 years old. Who? Oh, not him, his. Sorry, I was confusing him with somebody else. Someone who's been there for like 70, since the 40s or the 50s, who's a fairly important businessman, and he's someone who's been given a national identity, a national passport. And then a lot of people who, quote unquote, are not local but serve in the army will be given citizenship. So while a majority of the people who kind of like live and work in the area are function on residency permits or work permits, there are you know, examples of these people who are given citizenship strategically. I'm sorry?
How's the cricket team doing?
I have no idea. Actually, I don't think it's a very good cricket team, because anybody who worked their right mind from South Asia would actually want to play for India or Pakistan. It's one of the few things that countries of South Asia are good at, so sports-wise.
Squash?
Yeah, there is squash. Did you have a question?
Just kind of how the biennial, is it basically kind of a biennial that's based on the Venice model, where it's like an international people coming in, or like the Whitney biennial where it's basically American artists, or, I mean, is it a biennial that focuses on the regional art as a showcase, or are they, because the artists you showed were kind of European artists at the biennial, so I'm just kind of curious how that works.
I've been attending it regularly since 2005, and it's actually fairly mixed, and the organizers do a good job of trying to maintain that mix. So while they will have artists, like local artists and artists from the region, they will also have international artists. I think one of the things that is apparent in the history of the biennial is that there's been this constant struggle of not inviting people in from outside who are just going to sort of parachute in and do projects about the area in a sort of non-invested way. And so one of the things that the biennial has been doing is it's initiated artist residencies. And the Danish artist who I showed, who had this like 24-minute video installation that was these pendant images of the migrant worker and his family, he was someone who has been in the region since 2004 or 2005. He first came and did a six-month artist residency. And the other thing that the biennial has gradually shifted towards becoming a site of production, and so they've increased the amount of commissioning they do from, I don't remember the numbers off my head, but I don't think there were that many specifically commissioned projects in 2003, but in 2005, like the Breathes Truly project was a commission, and in 2007, the theme was about ecology, and I think roughly half the works were commissioned. And for this year's edition, they tried to make that a little more transparent by literally turning the biennial into into a production facilitator, where you could apply with a project, and then the biennial would consider it and would help you produce the project. It didn't quite work, in my opinion, as a viable strategy, but that's kind of the way the biennial is moving.
Okay.
And so like I said, there is always a mix. I'm surprised that there aren't more artists from Asia. And part of the reason why I sort of started thinking around down this Indian Ocean line is to shift the kind of locus or network of solidarities eastwards, because the Gulf is not only about the Middle East. And if it is about the Middle East, it's got a very conflicted relationship with the Levant the areas on the Middle Eastern coast and the Mediterranean coast, while it does have these very strong ties with, you know, South Asia and East Africa. And so I'm just, part of the idea of focusing in on this, on the Indian Ocean side, is maybe to open up the possibilities eastwards. Sorry, did you?
Oh, yeah. So my question was about your ideas about the way that this project sort of activates the Indian Ocean as the space of connection.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering how you would think about this project in relationship to, say, other kinds of projects that use the sort of metaphor or physical formation of, like, the Gulf or the Isthmus or the canal to do more of, like, a formal exploration that offers a way of connection, say, through a physical experience of a painting or an installation or a sculptural object.
Could you give me an example?
The names are escaping me, but all of the Isthmus sculptures, do you remember those from, I can't think of the name of the artist, but these kinds of, like, either sculptural or painterly kinds of practices that are taking, like, the idea of the Gulf or the idea of the Isthmus as a kind of way, and reconstituting it in a gallery space as a way of offering another kind of connection.
Mm-hmm.
Like how basically the question is more like how one might think about the formal ways that you could start to create these sorts of, to kind of re-engineer these spaces in an art context versus these more kinds of conceptual or interactive projects.
Well, actually, I'll admit that this project by Camp was kind of like incredibly uncanny, because some of these ideas were things that I had been thinking about before I encountered the project. And in a lot of ways, so in one way was this idea of the Indian Ocean, but the other way was the sort of particular lens they took to it, which was focusing on trade or transaction or a mode of travel or exchange, which itself is not sort of stable. And that's part of what I think makes it an effective project. And my problem with any sort of like representational work, like in a more traditional sense, is that it challenges, or it might tap into the ideas of these ideas as a sort of a set of symbols or representations, but it doesn't challenge it on an aesthetic level. And what I love about this project is that it's about traversing those divides in the realms of the project itself. Like, the project itself is created through discourse. I mean, it doesn't exist otherwise, especially with the radio performance. And so that's why I think it's superior to do a lot of, well, not superior. Superior is an awful word for a critic to say, but that's why I think it's more successful in some ways for me in relation to a couple of the other projects, which I do think fall into this trap of producing objects or producing representations of these ideas rather than having the ideas emerge out of a practice.
Yeah, and I guess the question is really more like, it does seem like one of the things one might say about this project is that it sort of seems, based on the way that you talked about it, to lack a sort of experiential center. Like, there wasn't really a space created where there was, say, a contact between the normal Sharjah exhibition goer and the kinds of people that were participating in the project. And so I was wondering kind of,
yeah.
On the one hand, it's like talking about this connection across the Indian Ocean. On the other hand, it seems like there's this sort of lack of a real cohesive space, either within a gallery or itself.
No, and actually, I mean, the more I've been thinking about it, that's actually a good question and a valid concern. But the more I've been thinking about it, I think actually that's where the project's strength lies, is that it actually very consciously stayed away. And it was funny because, like, it took me a while to find it, and I have some, you know, access to the language, but really, a lot of people had no idea where it was. And it was kind of a crazy week anyway. There was way too much going on. But they did very consciously not want to engage the biennial audience. And when you did go there, you could very clearly tell who were participants in the project, and all of these terms again are complicated, and I'm still not sure who the participants were, who the viewers were, who the object was, who the artwork was for. But you could very clearly tell who is part of the biennial audience and who is participating in the project, just because there was such a discrepancy. You'd have people who were literally just standing around, and those were very clearly the observers, the biennial audience. And I think that's a tension in the work, and I think it's interesting because the work theatricalized it to some degree rather than letting it emerge in through the mode of exhibition. It actually was kind of conscious of that and presented itself as being conscious of it up front. What that all means, I'm still not sure of.
Has it been represented elsewhere?
No, and actually I asked them, when I did do the interview, the initial interview, I asked them whether they would consider representing it, and they were very cagey about it, and they didn't think it could be represented.
Well,
and
it seems like it would go against their whole, intention.
Yeah, but knowing artists, I'm sure they will represent it somewhere. They may not, though. I mean, they're busy people. They wander the world doing a lot of things.
I have a question about the book.
Yeah.
It's so much data. They had spent so much time generating and collecting. Has anything been, created from that data? Have they went in other directions that was actually led by the data they collected? Or did they find trends that kind of inspired for the project?
Well, I think the one major trend that they found sort of depressingly was this sort of discrepancy between import and export. When I last talked to them, and they've been kind of hard to get in touch with of late, they said that they were continuing research, which is a common statement that a lot of artists who are engaged in research-based projects make. But they're continuing research, especially on the Gujarat end, because they're kind of curious about those communities there. Also, I guess it's close by to them, and so they can continue that research. Other than that, the two other things that they did mention in the interview, one was that the customs records actually hadn't been digitized, and there was some desire amongst the government to come up with a digitization system. So I don't know if that was a side effect of their attempts, because what they basically did, I mean, they're very tech-savvy people, and one of the guys who is a co-founder of the group is a computer programmer. And I think basically what he did was he came up with an interface that allowed for data entry that then produced the sorts of lists that we see. Other than that, I'm not so sure. I mean, that's another tension with the piece, is that really if you weren't there for those four nights, all you're experiencing is the book. And so what did it really achieve? And I don't think that their desire is really to effect a social change. Or if it is, it's purely on a symbolic level. I think there are artists who are more interested in working with social and political issues and social and political spaces than they are in actually effecting any sort of lasting change.
Well, like in Grant Kester's conversation pieces, the Suzanne Lacy piece,
yeah,
in Oakland, or so many other,
yeah. But he talks about that piece as actually producing lasting change, in her and in other people. But it's also, I mean, with a lot of works like this, you have to, I read this quote by Mary Jane Jacobs in another book that was about this mode of art making, where she said that to some degree you just have to have the belief that the work is going to produce something, that you just produce and you put it out there, and then it takes its own time. And so often the effects are not necessarily immediately perceptible, that they kind of unfold over time.
The issue with teaching.
Yeah.
You really don't know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so it's the same thing. We have no, unless someone does a scientific follow-up and follows the people, the different ship crews who participated and, figured out whether it had any lasting effect on their worldview or view of different cultures or things like that. There's no real way of knowing whether they're, was any lasting effect. Again, one of the things I think is kind of intriguing about the project is that it's not all there. It's not sort of written in stone. So I can project whatever I want onto it. Yeah.
There was no recording of the radio broadcast? Those were tested.
There was a lot of footage being shot. I knowing them, I'm sure that they recorded a lot of the radio broadcasts. I contacted them a month and a half ago about additional documentation, and nothing, I didn't hear back from them. So if it is, it's still in the works. They're probably still editing it.
Because it seems like recording it might even kind of weaken. But, you know, if it's about, like, just allowing the interactions to happen,
yeah,
you're sort of taking away the ephemeral.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's sort of like an important consideration with any form of sort of performance art, you know, the tension between the performance as an ephemeral practice and then the documentation of the performance, and how often there's, you know, sort of quintessential works of performance art, they're remembered by these sort of quintessential photographs, which in some cases were actually staged for the photograph, and in some cases they weren't, and in some cases they just happened to capture action. But it's like, you know, the ephemerality requires documentation, but then the documentation becomes the art object rather than sort of the experience, which of course can never be recreated. And even for me, who had some command of the language, I mean, I had no idea what was going on half the time, because there were a lot of different languages. I mean, India, South Asia alone has, I don't even know, 45 or 50 dialects, and a lot of the people were singing in their own dialects and conversing in their own dialects, and this sort of Urdu or Hindustani that's spoken across South Asia was kind of like the common language. But there was definitely a lot going on that even I just didn't know. So
you had said that the UAE doesn't allow for protests in the beginning.
Did, yeah.
So was there some sort of, from the higher-ups, governmental level, kind of saying, like, oh, we need to see all the artwork we're going to be showing or presenting or whatnot in the biennial before it actually...
Well, I think that's actually been another tension in Sharjah that's been interesting to follow, is this issue of censorship. Because to some degree, you actually have like a benevolent monarch who's supporting culture, but then on the other hand, you also, it's still a monarchy, and they do control what can and cannot be executed within the sort of structure of the biennial. Having said that, I feel like the biennial's been a fairly critical space. And I think the curators and the artists involved have done it very interestingly. Like, the themes, not this year's theme, but the last theme was ecology. And with the focus on oil in this economy and the ridiculous rate of development, ecology is kind of like a touchy subject. But that was the theme of the last biennial. The one before that was belonging, again, for a country that's like 80% immigrant and doesn't give citizenship out very easily. It's a touchy subject, and there have been cases of censorship, but then, you know, there have also been artists thinking very cleverly of ways to get around that. And to some degree, I wonder whether maybe the ephemerality of the performance aspect of this was necessary, because, you know, you kind of say that this is what we're going to do, and you just leave it at that, and unless you're going to have, like, authorities policing all 4 nights and carefully figuring out what's going to happen and what sorts of conversations are being had, there's no way of controlling it. And so it happens, and it's an event, and then it sort of, its effects may linger, may not linger, but it did happen during that time period. So,
it's, yeah. One of, like, the princesses or someone, a key person who established this capital? Like,
yeah.
Isn't it already a state, there is a state representative already?
Yeah, so I mean, this is the other thing. I mean, the Sharjah Biennial is a really, really interesting little entity, because it allows you to sort of question a lot of your beliefs in relation to biennial and avant-gardism and critical art, because it inherently allows for a certain degree of criticality within a structure that's authoritarian. And so it makes you wonder how radical critical practice in other spaces actually is, you know, because arguably the biennial or the museum allows for a certain degree of institutional critique at this point in time, that those forms of institutional critique are not necessarily radical anymore. And so I think because it's this weirdly sort of simultaneously progressive and authoritarian space, it allows a lot of these things that are hidden otherwise in other parts of the world to come into relief. The other thing is how much the art world depends on alcohol. Because invariably, a criticism with people who go to Sharjah is that there's no alcohol at the opening, and you're like, how can I look at art? And I'm just like, well. On that note, maybe we should all break for some wine. That was my little lame attempt at a segue.